I want you to picture the most permanent, rigid thing you can think of. For most people, that's probably what, a steel beam.
Or one of those huge industrial coils of metal you see on a factory floor.
Exactly. And when you look at that, you see something static. It's done. It's set in stone, so to speak.
It gives you this illusion of permanence. I mean, it's why we build skyscrapers out of it. We trust it not to change.
Right. But if you dig into the research we've got for today's deep dive, that trust is, well, it's a little misplaced. Because if you zoom way, way down to the microscopic level, that rigid steel is actually kind of stressed out.
It is. It's actively trying to relax.
And if you give it just half a chance, really just a little bit of heat, it will completely tear down and rebuild its own internal architecture.
Relax is a very gentle way of putting it. It's more like a chaotic scramble for a lower energy state.
True. The process is called spheroidization. It's basically the story of how hard layered steel tries to turn itself into a pile of soft microscopic spheres. We're pulling this from a really dense scientific analysis. The title is Spheroid Analysis and Scientific Discourse. And we're zeroing in on the chapter about perlite and steels.
And this isn't just, abstract physics for a textbook. This is about why a train track might suddenly fail, or why a nuclear reactor design from the 50s got clogged up.
Or why a 20-ton coil of steel might just collapse under its own weight, like a squashed roll of toilet paper.
That image is a good one. A very expensive squashed roll of toilet paper.
We will get to that particular disaster later. But first, we really have to set up the why. Because to me, the entire point of steel is its hardness. Why would any engineer want to intentionally turn the hardest parts of steel into soft little spheres?
It really just comes down to the practical side of things. Manufacturing.
Okay.
Steel doesn't just, pop into existence in the shape of a gear or a drive shaft. You have to cut it. You have to machine it.
And you can't really cut something that's fighting back too hard.
Precisely. If you take a piece of really high-strength steel with that rigid, layered structure and you try to run it through a mill, you're just going to destroy your cutting tools.
It's too brutal.
Yeah, it chips, it breaks, it literally screams at you.
So it's kind of like the difference between trying to carve a statue out of granite versus, say, carving it out of hard clay.
That's a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
So before you do any of that machining, engineers need the steel to be soft in what we call an annealed state. Spheroidization is that process. It's annealing.
You use heat to do it.
You use heat to break down those hard internal layers, which act like walls, and you turn them into these little isolated spheres.
And spheres don't block movement.
Think of them like tiny ball bearings inside the metal. The iron matrix around them can flow and deform so much more easily. Then, once you've machined your part into whatever complex shape you need, you can heat treat it again to harden it all back up.
Okay, so layers are hard, spheres are soft. Got it. That's the rule. But figuring out how a solid layer of metal just decides to break up into balls, that takes us on a pretty weird historical detour.
It does.
I was reading the background in our source material, and suddenly I'm in the 19th century with a guy named Wilhelm Ostwald.
Ah, Oswald. He's basically the father of physical chemistry, a giant in the field.
And back in the late 1800s, he was just watching crystals grow in a solution.
Yeah, and he noticed something odd. They weren't behaving democratically.
Right. The big ones were bullying the little
They
ones.
were. He saw that if you have a mix of large crystals and small crystals in the same liquid, the large ones just keep getting larger,
Yeah.
and the small ones, they shrink and eventually disappear.
The big eat the small.
It's a thermodynamic land grab. We call it Ostwald ripening now. Oswald figured out that the system as a whole was just trying to reduce its total energy.
And that energy is all tied up in the surface area.
Exactly. Nature hates surface area. It costs energy to maintain a surface. So if you have a million tiny crystals, that's a huge amount of surface area. But if you combine all their mass into one big crystal, the total surface area plummets.
The system is just trying to be lazy.
Fundamentally, yes.
Okay, that's crystals in a jar. But the source makes this incredible jump here that I loved. We go from 19th century chemistry to a failed nuclear reactor design in the 1950s.
This is the Jeffrey Greenwood story. It's a perfect example of how scientific principles just pop up in totally unrelated fields.
So Greenwood wasn't even studying steel?
Not at all. He was working on a reactor fueled by a uranium slurry.
Slurry is not a word I like to hear next to uranium.
No, it was a very ambitious idea. Instead of solid fuel rods, they wanted to suspend tiny uranium particles in liquid bismuth and pump this radioactive slush through the reactor core.
Liquid bismuth carrying uranium. It sounds like something out of a pulp sci-fi novel.
It was very real. And it failed very, very quickly. The design was a complete bust because the fuel lines kept getting clogged.
Let me guess, Ostwald ripening.
Exactly that. The tiny uranium particles wouldn't stay tiny. As they circulated in the hot liquid bismuth, they started to ripen. They clumped into bigger and bigger chunks to reduce their surface energy.
And eventually, they just blocked the pipes. The fuel basically curdled.
It did. But Greenwood, being a brilliant scientist, didn't just walk away. He studied why it failed. He took Ostwald's logic from 60 years earlier, applied it to his clumping nuclear fuel, and came up with a mathematical formula.
That's equation 9.1 in our source material.
That's the one. And that equation, which was born from a failed nuclear experiment, is still the standard mathematical basis we use today to understand how particles grow and change in solid steel.
That is just wild. So the math we use to make a gear for your car comes from a clogged pipe in a 1950s atomic experiment.
The laws of physics don't care if the atom is uranium or iron. The drive to reduce energy is universal.
So let's apply that to steel. We've established that particles want to get bigger to save energy. But in steel, we're not starting with particles, we're starting with layers, with perlite.
Right. Perlite is a lamellar structure. Think of it as alternating layers of ferrite, which is almost pure iron, and cementite, which is iron carbide.
So if I have a flat layer, a plate of the cementite, why does it want to become a sphere? I mean, a plate seems pretty stable.
It seems stable to us, but to an atom, a plate is full of high energy problems, specifically at the edges.
Ah, okay.
And this brings us to the core mechanism, which is called the Gibbs-Thompson effect.
Okay, break that down for us.
The Gibbs-Thompson effect just says there's a relationship between how curved a surface is and how much energy the atoms on that surface have.
So an atom on a sharp corner is different from one on a flat plane.
Very different. Think of an atom sitting on the sharp, curved edge of a plate. It's more exposed. It has fewer neighbors holding it in place compared to an atom on a nice, flat surface. It's in a high-energy state.
It's basically under pressure to leave.
In a sense, yes. It wants to escape. So the atoms at those sharp edges will actually dissolve into the surrounding iron and then diffuse, they move, towards the flatter surfaces where the energy is lower.
So the sharp edges literally dissolve and that material gets redeposited on the flat sides.
Exactly. The sharp bits vanish and the flat bits start to bulge out. Over time, the whole thing just rounds itself off. And what's the one shape with the absolute minimum surface area for its volume?
A sphere.
A sphere. So spheroidization is just the material trying to obey the Gibbs-Thompson effect to minimize its total energy.
Now here's where the source material corrected a big misconception I had. When I picture perlite, I see like a perfect stack of pancakes.
Right.
You know, alternating layers, perfectly flat, going on forever. But the text says that's just wrong.
It's a textbook simplification, and it really hurts our understanding of what's actually going on. Real perlite is messy. It's a three-dimensional interconnected maze.
So the cementite plates aren't perfect sheets.
Not at all. They have holes in them, twists, places where they just stop. They're full of defects.
More like Swiss cheese than a stack of pancakes.
Swiss cheese is a much better mental image, and those holes are absolutely critical.
Because they're filled with ferrite.
Right, and the edges of those holes have high curvature.
High curvature means high energy.
Which means they are the trigger points. Spheroidization starts right at these defects. The holes grow and eat away at the plate. The plate breaks up into ribbons, and then the ribbons snap into little particles. If perlite were actually a perfect defect-free structure, the process would take, well, practically forever.
Speaking of forever, let's talk about speed. Because in a factory, time is money. You can't just wait around. How fast is this?
On its own. Incredibly slow. The main bottleneck is the self-diffusion of iron. For the cementite to change shape, iron atoms have to physically move out of the way.
And iron atoms are heavy, they're stubborn.
They have a very high activation energy. The source gives a value, Q, of around 170 to 240 kilojoules per mole. To give you some perspective, at 700 degrees Celsius, so bright red, hot moving in interface, just 10 micrometers.
Which is what, a fraction of a human hair?
A tiny fraction, yeah. That could take over 50 hours.
50 hours? You can't run a furnace for 2 days for every batch of steel. So how do engineers cheat? How do they speed it up?
They add energy to the system before they even start heating it. They use a process called cold rolling.
It's like something you do with dough?
It's more like beating the steel up. You pass it through these massive rollers to deform it while it's cold. It smashes the crystal structure, fills it with defects, with dislocations.
So you're damaging the steel on purpose.
You're storing mechanical energy in it. You're pre-stressing it. So when you finally do heat it up, all that stored energy acts like a booster rocket. It desperately wants to be released.
And that makes the whole process faster.
Radically faster. The source has a figure, 9.5, that shows cold-rolled perlite spheroiduses so much quicker than normal steel. You cut the time from days down to hours, or sometimes even minutes.
Okay, so we can hit the gas by beating up the steel, but can we hit the brakes? What if you want the layers to stay as layers?
Then you have to look at your recipe. You change the alloy, you add things like manganese or silicon.
And how do those elements stop the process?
It's a mechanism called partitioning. For the cementite to change shape, remember, both carbon and iron have to move. If you add manganese, it's a heavy atom that likes to hang out in the cementite, but it moves very slowly.
So it's like a slow person blocking the doorway?
Exactly. It clogs up the interface. Carbon can't get in or out easily because the manganese is in the way. Silicon does the opposite. It hates the cementite and tries to run away into the ferrite. But that act of fleeing also creates a microscopic traffic jam.
So you're putting up roadblocks at the atomic level.
You are. A pure iron-carbon steel will coarsen very quickly. Add a little bit of manganese, and the rate just falls off a cliff. It gives engineers an incredible amount of control.
There's one term in the source that I found really funny, but the implications are actually pretty serious. The divorced eutectoid.
It is probably the most dramatic-sounding term in all of physical metallurgy.
It sounds like a legal drama. What's actually getting divorced?
The ferrite and the cementite are. Normally, when steel cools down from a high temperature, the ferrite and cementite grow together, cooperatively. They form those nice alternating layers, side by side, like a team.
Okay.
In a divorce transformation, that teamwork completely breaks down. This tends to happen if you already have some little cementite particles floating around in the steel before it starts to cool.
So there's already some baggage in the relationship.
Exactly. As the steel cools, the carbon basically looks around and says, why should I do all the hard work of building a brand new layer structure? I'm just going to diffuse over to that particle that's already there and stick to it.
It just takes the path of least resistance. It skips the whole layer building stage.
Completely. You go straight to spheres. No layers ever even form.
That actually sounds incredibly efficient if what you want is spheres.
It is. For certain things, like making the raceways for ball bearings, it's the gold standard. You get a soft, easily machinable structure right out of the gate.
So the divorce is good for bearings, but the source says it's terrible for something else.
It is a disaster for rails.
For train tracks.
Yes. Specifically, welded train tracks.
Mm-hmm.
When you weld two sections of rail together, you create this zone of intense heat right next to the weld, the heat-affected zone.
And in that zone,
you can accidentally trigger this divorced eutectoid transformation. You create a zone of spheres in a structure that is supposed to be hard, rigid layers.
You're creating a soft spot right in the track.
A significant one. The source says the hardness can drop from 360 HV all the way down to 260 HV.
That's a huge drop.
It is. It creates a weak link. And under the constant pounding of a heavy freight train, that soft spot can deform, it can wear out, or it can even lead to a crack.
It's just wild that the exact same microscopic process is a manufacturing miracle for one thing and a catastrophic failure for another.
It's all about context. Material is just doing what thermodynamics tells it to do. It's up to us to understand that context.
Speaking of catastrophic failure, we have to talk about the coil collapse. We teased it at the start. The source has a photo, figure 9.8, and it is honestly shocking to look at.
That is a very expensive picture.
Can you describe it for us?
So imagine a standard, huge industrial steel coil. It looks like a giant roll of silver toilet paper, right? Perfectly round, tightly wound, weighing maybe 20 tons.
Okay, I can picture that.
In the photo, the coil is just slumped. It's not round anymore. It's an oval. It looks like it was made of wet clay and somebody just sat on it.
So did they drop it from a crane? What happened?
Nothing happened. Gravity did that.
Gravity squashed a 20-ton coil of steel.
The steel became so soft that it couldn't even support its own weight.
How is that possible?
It was a perfect storm of spheroidization happening way too fast. The source explains this was a hypotectoid steel, so it had a relatively low carbon content.
Yeah.
And they coiled it while it was still very hot, maybe around 600, 700 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
And because the chemistry and the temperature were in this disastrous sweet spot, the perlite transformed into spheres almost instantly.
It relaxed too much, too fast.
It completely lost its structural integrity. The layers that normally give it stiffness just dissolved into these slippery spheres that offer no resistance. The metal basically turned to mush, and the coil just slumped.
And I'm guessing you can't feed an oval coil into a machine?
No. That's total scrap. You have to melt the whole thing down and start over. A massive loss.
What's the fix? You just coil it colder.
The source suggests adjusting the conditions in the hot strip mill. You have to control the cooling to make sure the carbon concentration in what's left of the austenite is high enough to prevent that runaway reaction. You have to force it to hold its shape.
It just really underlines that making steel is this incredible high wire act. You're balancing temperature, chemistry, time, and if you miss by just a little bit, your 20-ton product turns into a puddle.
You are actively fighting the material's natural tendencies. You're fighting entropy itself.
So let's wrap this up. We started with Oswald watching crystals in a jar.
And realized that big things eat small things to save energy.
Which took us to a clogged nuclear reactor that gave us the math we still use for steel today.
We looked at the mechanism, the Gibbs-Thompson effect,
yeah,
and how atoms literally flee from sharp edges because they're stressed out. And we learned that real steel is full of these little holes and defects that kick the whole thing off.
We saw how we can play with time speeding things up, with cold rolling, slowing them down with manganese.
And we saw the real world consequences. The divorced eutectoid making bearings possible, but destroying rail welds.
And those slumped coils, the ones that just got too comfortable and let gravity win.
It really changes how you look at the solid world around you. We think of these things as static, but they're not. They're incredibly dynamic systems.
And that's the final thought I want to leave everyone with. The source kind of hints at this. This whole process, spheroidization, it's just the material trying to reach equilibrium. It wants to be a sphere.
A sphere is the lowest energy state. It's the most stable form.
So if even the hardest steel beam in a skyscraper is on a long enough timeline trying to relax into a blob of spheres, is any structure we build actually permanent?
Or is everything just slowly, microscopically, on its way to becoming a ball?
If you wait long enough, entropy always wins.
The sphere is the destiny of all things.
On that cheery thought about the inevitable heat death of the universe, thank you for listening to this deep dive. And maybe go give your local bridges a second look. We'll see you next time.